So that's the first part of my talk.
I hope you can see. All right, what's this supposed to do?
We're going to record it.
Oh, right, you're recording it. Okay, as well. Good. Second, I will illustrate that the unchanging character of marriage is, in fact, its very openness to change, which is why so many people still want it, including many lesbian and gay people. Thank God for that. Third, I'll summarize some contemporary theological accounts of marriage. So that is to take up the question that Charlotte left us with. Well, what is Christian marriage anyway? I will attack that question head on. In order to show, finally, when I get there, that these accounts are welcoming to same-sex marriage and to same-sex couples requesting God's blessing on their marriage. So those are the four things that I set myself to do in the next few minutes, and maybe there'll be time for a postscript on married love, and maybe there won't. So first of all then, whose definitions? There is no single permanent definition of marriage. We who advocate opening the doors of marriage to couples of the same sex are accused of changing that definition. Our opponents don't seem to realize that marriage has always been changing. They hide the untenable assumption that marriage somehow has an essence unchanging through time, whereas the enduring appeal of marriage may lie in its very flexibility, in its uncanny ability to generate new meanings and to inspire new commitments. In fact, I think marriage as an institution is supremely flexible, and that is why it has survived this day. The Church of England rejected the possibility of affirming same-sex marriage in its response in June 2012 to the government's consultation on its intention to legislate on the matter. And it put forward two arguments why it couldn't go along with government proposals. One of these was from the intrinsic nature of marriage. That is clearly an appeal to what in gender theory is called essentialism. Same-sex marriage would, it was alleged, alter the intrinsic nature of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, as enshrined in human institutions throughout history. But there is no intrinsic nature of marriage. Suppose there was, how would we recognize it? The human institutions of marriage have also enshrined polygamy, or rather polygyny, one man, several women. We all remember, well, maybe not all of us, but many of us remember, a decade or so ago, those who opposed what was going through General Synod, that is to say, to permit in some circumstances further marriage, they based their key argument on the intrinsic nature of marriage. You can't have further marriage because that contradicts the intrinsic nature of marriage. Permanence then belonged to its intrinsic nature, but now it seems that neither monogamy nor permanence do belong to the intrinsic nature of marriage, but for some strange reason heterosexuality does. And one wonders why there has been such maneuvering about these matters. The meanings of marriage, then, within Christianity are determined by Christians themselves, and in particular by theologians reflecting on the experience of married followers of Jesus Christ in the light of scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. And that's a very different task from asserting that there is somehow this permanent definition of marriage, which of course has been put there for the sole purpose of excluding problematic couples from joining it. But Christian marriage does have a history, and that history develops as the church seeks the mind of Christ in each new generation. So I'm going to go on to my second part of my talk now, the changing understanding of marriage. The Hebrew Bible endorses marriage, but not as we know it today. It also endorses polygyny. Women are not full subjects in the Pentateuch, but are dispensable, being always the property of men. Jesus challenged that. Matthew and Mark recording his opposition to easy divorce. The New Testament, though, is much less positive towards marriage than the Hebrew Bible. Luke depicts Jesus as being against marriage. See Luke 20, 34 to 36. For Paul, it's never more than a concession to lust, hardly a theological basis for mutual love. The household codes of the New Testament, however, assume that many Christians marry. Their marriages, as we've seen this morning, were far from being egalitarian. And the early church, following 1 Corinthians 7, and two texts attributed to Jesus, which I've got somewhere here. Never mind, I'll come back to it. Took the view that while marriage is good, celibacy is better. So most historical scholarship, most New Testament scholarship that I grew up with, always tried to emphasize the unity of the New Testament, as if there was no disagreement anywhere in it. Well, nowadays we think about the sheer diversity of views within the New Testament, and certainly there is a sheer diversity of views in the New Testament about marriage. And far from that being an embarrassment, it is indeed, I think, a profound advantage for thinking about marriage in the postmodern church. So, about half the adults today in the UK are not married. Well, they've clearly been reading St. Paul and making good use of his advice to avoid it. There will be anxieties, there will be cares, and if you don't get married, says St. Paul, then you're not going to have all those problems. So many feminists and not a few divorcees agree with Paul that marriage is best avoided because it is such a source of anxiety. And we need to hold that view against the view that actually it's a sacrament. So the reconciling of those views is not particularly easy. The purpose of marriage from the second century on was singular: procreation. Jerome strongly discouraged marriage. Jovinian thought that marriage and celibacy were equal. What happened to him? Kicked out of the church for that. Excommunicated for heresy. And Augustine's work on the goodness of marriage was a mediating position, defining its threefold purpose as children, faithfulness, and sacramentality. Now, the extent to which Augustine thought marriage was a sacrament probably amounts to this. The oath a Roman soldier took was called a sacramentum. And so it's a vow of unconditional loyalty. And it didn't, in Augustine's time, have the sense it came to have, that it was one of the two, or in this case, one of the seven sacraments of the Christian Church. So there in my slides, there's a reference, which you've seen already this morning, to St. Paul saying that marriage is not really advised, that singleness might actually be better. And those are the three rival positions in the 4th century. Jerome thinking that marriage is to be strongly discouraged, sexual desire is to be overcome by prayer and by fasting. Jovinian saying that marriage and celibacy were equal, and the church wouldn't have anything to do with that. Celibacy was very much better. And then Augustine's view, and I do think he was a sex addict, never fully recovered, offering a middle way, but a middle way which in the end seems very far from anywhere where we would want to identify the center. So there's Augustine and his three goods up there on the overhead. And now I move, but very briefly, there is a point to this though, to the Council of Verona, which in 1184 declares marriage to be a sacrament in the formal sense, although it isn't until 1215 that that is ratified. What that meant was sacramental grace would convert the desire for sex into the desire for babies. The sacramentum is the medicinum, it's medicine for lust. So when we speak about marriage having sacramental efficacy or grace, okay, let's hope that there are a fluid range of meanings that we can put in there, because one of them, I suggest, is seriously inadequate. The legal framework for marriage was shared or hammered out in the 13th century. And one of the issues, I won't stray onto Charlotte's territory at this point that we've already heard, but one of the issues around the 13th to the, well, certainly in the 13th and 14th centuries, was whether marriage was about love. And that was under the influence of a movement called courtly love. And actually, this has a very 21st century ring about it in some senses, even though it's like 1,000 years old. Could marriage be about the affection between husband and wife? That's a lovely little phrase, maritalis affectio. Could marriage be defined then as a partnership, a consortium? It's a lovely, lovely word. Of the whole of life and for the whole of life, a consortium omnis or totius vitae. Now, these were serious arguments around the turn of the second millennium. And they're strikingly modern ideas. They got nowhere because the canon lawyers didn't like them. How can you verify maritalis affectio? Affectio, that is notoriously fickle. Affectio can come and affectio can go. So legal marriage, and this was settled in the 13th century, was to be the exchange of consent in the present tense between individuals, not families, individuals in the presence of witnesses. And that remains, as far as I know, the legal basis for marriage in all Western democracies and countries influenced by them. The presence of love in marriage might have been assumed, but it remained no more than really a thread in the church's teaching about it. Now, the question whether a marriage was a real marriage was a very difficult question, and it was determined by the problem of the marriage of the Blessed Virgin. And I promise there is a serious point here which has searing relevance for discussion about marriage now. Now, at 381, the 4th century, the virginity of Mary became regarded as perpetual. She was ever virgin. So, leaving aside the rather serious problem of the Lord's brothers and sisters, Mary was assumed never to have had sex with anyone. So, since people only married in the 13th century to have sex for the purpose of procreation, how could the marriage of Mary and Joseph be a real marriage? And that was a problem that lasted for a whole century, with the Parisians saying one thing and the Romans saying the other. And this is how they resolved the problem. They resolved the problem by saying, that marriage was ratified by the exchange of consent. Consent makes the marriage. Consent ratifies, consent makes the marriage, and then having sex after consent, of course, that consummated the marriage, and failure to consummate it qualified for annulment if annulment were desired. So, in the case of Mary and Joseph, then, you can see how what's driving this strange solution. Because they consented, their sexless marriage was nonetheless a real marriage. And the consequence was that consummation of marriage was defined by a single biologistic act. To quote from the relevant Roman Catholic marriage law, a marriage is consumed if the spouses have in a human manner engaged together in a conjugal act, in itself apt for the generation of offspring. So, what makes marriage, in the Church's view, from the 13th century onwards, and the Reformation doesn't interfere with this, is consent. Consummation, or rather the lack of it, becomes a ground for annulment. Now, this issue, this is a sensitive point, represents itself in the case of the question, is a gay marriage a real marriage? Is a lesbian marriage a real marriage? According to John Milbank, it isn't. You can't really have equal marriage, he said in Modern Believing earlier this year, because sexual consummation can't be the criterion for gay marriage. Well, assuming that we can speak about criteria in this connection at all, Milbank forgets that sexual consummation was never the criterion for straight marriage either. The criterion for all marriage from the 13th century onwards is consent. And that is precisely what lesbian and gay people who are desiring marriage now, they wish to give their consent. The question about consummation is irrelevant to that. Consensus facit. Yes, facit. Matrimonium. Consent makes the marriage. And so there is, I think, a very useful understanding of marriage that derives from around this time. Marriage begins with betrothal, with the spousals. There's no such thing as engagement until the 18th century, until the Hardwick Marriage Act. Really, I mean, there are Bible experts who talk about engagement. There is no engagement in the Bible, but there are five cases of men and women becoming betrothed before they marry, the most famous, of course, being Mary and Joseph. When I see that people have become engaged, I think of an occupied lavatory. You know, what's that got to do with betrothal? People married differently then, and the church is suffering from amnesia in this respect. It thinks marriages begin with weddings. There are vicars who think this. There are vicars who think that they actually marry couples that come to them, not that the couple marry themselves, which has always been the teaching of the church. We forget all this. So marriage begins with betrothal, with the spousals, with the promise to marry in the future tense. And some of our liturgies still have these two questions, one in the future tense and one in the present tense. Do you wonder why? Well, it goes back 1,000 years. Because marriage begins when you promise to wed in the future. That is matrimonium initiatum. Then you might have a wedding. You would have a wedding. That would be the ratification of your vows, the matrimonium ratum. Then matrimonium consummatum, understanding why that comes in. That comes in because, of course, Mary and Joseph had a real marriage, but they never had any sex. And suppose you never had a visit to the church for the spousals, for the actual wedding ceremony. Well, matrimonium presumptum would be your state. You would be presumed married, whether you'd had the ceremony or not. And the Hardwick Marriage Act never covered Scotland. And right until, I think, the early 20th century, matrimonium presumptum, I need to check this, was recognised in Scottish law. So marriage has been very different in the past. The idea that you shouldn't have sex before you get married. I mean, for years I've been offering students a prize, you know, thousands of pounds if they can show me where the Bible says that. What happens after the Hardwick Marriage Act of 1753 is that couples think, well, thank you very much, but we're going to carry on getting married and having our spouses and our nuptials at different times, whatever the church says, whatever Parliament says. So what happens? Every time I say this, I meet disbelief on the faces of people who've heard it for the first time. Some books say 40%, some books say 50%. Of all couples arriving at the altar in the 1760s were pregnant. So much for no sex before marriage, because the church has now forgotten that the entry into marriage was never a single event at which sacramental grace mysteriously came down and became infused in the couple's lives. No, it was a process into which one grew. And that is so important when pastoral counselling is given to couples who come to the church now to be married, and they come from the same address. I mean, it's the same even at Cana weekends in the Roman Catholic Church. People sleep with each other before they come to the church for the marriage. Well, get used to it. It's not new. Indeed, the Book of Common Prayer talks about the marriage service in terms of the solemnization of matrimony. You are already married when you get there. What you do when you're there is you have your relationship solemnized, recognized, blessed by God. So that's a whole different way of thinking about marriage. It is, of course, deeply traditional. And that's the point about having a postmodern or a late modern theology of marriage. There's so much in the tradition that is deeply relevant and that the conservatives have forgotten all about and do not want to be directed to. Right, I don't know where the hell I am now. somehow I've got on to ahead of myself, but I do want to. This slide is in my collection, and I've used it to show just how controlled marriage used to be in earlier times. So you might not be able to see this very clearly. Maybe it's as well you can't. But it's about the number of times in a year, if you're married, you can have sex with your partner. And it isn't very many. Like the maximum of 110 days. So, first of all, if you want it, well, you've got to keep your clothes on. You've got to try not to enjoy it. You have to want to have a child. You have to be, of course, married to a partner. And then it's got to be the right time of the month. And it can't be in Lent. It can't be in Advent either. We could go into that in more detail. It can't be in Whitsun week. It can't be in Easter week. It can't be on a feast day. It can't be on Sunday. It's taken me 50 years to find out why it can't be on a Wednesday. and the answer, I think, is because there is a verse, I think it's in John's Gospel, I haven't checked, which is about the devil entering into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray Jesus. And they worked out that was on a Wednesday. So Wednesday night is the devil's night out. And so you've got to keep your legs closed. So, and you can't have it on Saturday, because that's before Sunday. You can't even read that. Are you in church, in a sense? Well, it's taken me a long time to find out why you couldn't have sex in church. But I think I now know. It's in case, let me put this delicately, any bodily fluids accidentally touch the ground. And if they did, well, a bishop had to be summoned to purify the church again so that it could be fit for worship after such a desecration. So anyone who thinks that there is constancy in marital thought just has to cope with history. And we will see an evolving, not necessarily all in a kind of leisurely or measured pace, but an evolving understanding of sexuality and marriage as well. And in the last few years, I'm going to skip some of these things and talk instead about the recent changes to marriage in the last 60 or so years. The first one has been from the institutional to the personal. All institutions are having to invent themselves, aren't they? Like national parliaments, monarchies, universities, churches, companies. Marriage, like the monarchy, is still popular, but while the royals confine themselves to ceremony, high visibility, and the cult of celebrity, marriage has undergone a price. I mean, it remains popular, but at the price of becoming a symbol of love. And actually, I want to advocate that with all the powers that I have between two marrying parties. But couples tend to think that marrying is their own business. They're less and less interested in the social approval that the institution would once have been thought to confer upon them. A second switch or change is from the formal to the optional. Until recently, marriage was regarded as the only family form where the raising of children was acceptable. Now about half of children are brought up by their biological married parents. Couples are increasingly doubting whether a wedding adds anything to their lifelong intentions towards each other. And I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just trying to describe what's going on. A third change is from the public to the private. The 18th and 19th centuries saw women confined increasingly to the private sphere. And women have now come out of that closet and they're not going back in it. The institution of marriage has become a more private matter. It's no longer the business of school teachers and bank managers or inspectors of taxes to ask questions about the marital status of parents, customers, or earners. And wealthy couples now seek weddings as well as honeymoons away from their localities in exotic locations, as if it's got nothing to do with the neighbours. It's nothing even to do with the immediate family. We just want to get away from everybody. You know, that I describe. And then, fourthly, from the hierarchical to the egalitarian. Christian households have been dominated by husbands. Indeed, if you read books on family etiquette in the 17th and 18th centuries, you see that men were not even part of their families at all. They governed them. They weren't members of them. Just when a man spoke about his family, that was what he meant. It was his. That he was a member of it may never have occurred to him. And the pattern of the household codes that we were talking about this morning has been kept still in some parts of Christendom. The wonderful thing is that women now run international companies, although there aren't enough of them. They pilot aeroplanes, they command Her Majesty's ships, and they're simply not going to return to docile obedience in home or in church. Thank God for that. And for most couples, including Christians, the only version of marriage on offer is an egalitarian one where there is a full partnership of equals. Well, I hope to have shown then that marriage, the institution which same-sex couples have joined, has a changing history, one matched by a changing understanding of what it is and what it does. Within the Christian era, there have been deep changes regarding how it is entered into and at what age, whether it's open to clergy, whether it's a sacrament, what, if anything, it signifies in the human relation to God. Now, it's not difficult to establish that marriage has been a changing institution. Same-sex marriage, however, is a profound change, akin to that of opening up marriage to the clergy. And not all proposals for change are acceptable. Christian teaching has consistently assumed that marriage is between a man and a woman. Some further arguments are clearly needed, and in the next section, I want to show that there are strong theological arguments for claiming that the change should be warmly welcomed. So, I'm going to spend not more than a minute on each of 8 pictures of marriage, which are not mine, but which can be found by anyone who opens some theological books, listens to what is going on in various parts of the church. My first of the 8 models or pictures is the union of heart, body, and mind. Jesus spoke himself of marriage as one flesh, citing Genesis 2:24, and adding, "What God has joined together, let no one separate." And various meanings have been thought to flow from this uncompromising accomplishment of marriage, most obviously that a marriage approved by God is indissoluble. In the Genesis story, the man and the woman are one flesh, because the woman has been made from the flesh and bones of the man. The man recognizes his own body in the body of the woman that the Lord God has brought to him. And that saying about one flesh has not been favorable to women over time. It's been used to support the legal inclusion of a wife's body and property within her husband's body and property. She belonged to her husband in a total, irrevocable, and unidirectional way, second in the order of creation and deriving from the man. She is second in the hierarchy of gender. We now see dangers in one flesh. It stifles. It leaves little space for interdependence, for independence and individuality. And there are more positive ways of reading one flesh, namely as a union of body, mind, and heart, where there is no gender hierarchy, but a mutual interdependence. Second, marriage is often spoken of as a covenant. An important document from the Second Vatican Council says, "The intimate partnership of married life and love has been established by the Creator and qualified by his laws and is rooted in the conjugal covenant of irrevocable personal consent." Marriage, apparently for the first time in Roman Catholic thought, is called a foedus, a covenant, an image and a sharing in the covenant of love between Christ and his church. Calvin is the author of the idea of marriage as a covenant in Protestant traditions. And with careful qualification, God's relationship to God's people in the First Testament can be seen as a covenant. While part of the contemporary value of speaking of marriage as a covenant is its implied contrast with a contract. The understanding of marriage as a covenant offered by the church to marrying couples, whether or not they are believers, expresses the specialness of their intentions, I think, in a way that nudges them towards faith. Because the Christian faith is a covenant. That's what it is. That's what testament means. The New Testament is the new covenant. Marriage offers a different level of human relationship that contrasts with other personal human relationships and is a defense against the temptation within advanced societies to treat people as things by introducing notions of dominance, ownership, calculation, obsolescence, We have all those in our relationships with things. The point about speaking of marriage as a covenant is to lift it from that thingification and make it into something holy and sacred. Thirdly, marriage is an image of the new covenant. The covenant which is marriage tells us about what Christianity is. For the Christian faith is a covenant that Christ seals with his own blood. The idea of the new covenant defines the arrangement of the Christian scriptures into two parts. Pope John Paul II made the striking connection between the covenant of marriage and the covenant that is Christianity when he said, "The covenant of love between God and people, a fundamental part of the revelation and faith experience of Israel, finds a meaningful expression in the marriage covenant which is established between a man and a woman." For this reason, the central word of revelation, "God loves his people," is likewise proclaimed through the living and concrete word whereby a man and a woman express their conjugal love. Their bond of love becomes the image and the symbol of the covenant which unites God and his people. In many respects, John Paul II was a radical. In many respects, he was deeply conservative. But here is a pope speaking, I think, for the first time in this kind of a way. What he envisages is the mingling of divine love with human love, such that human love comes to fruition in the partnership of the whole of life, that consortium totius vitae that I was speaking about earlier. The bond of love between married couples is what they have in common with the covenant love of God for God's people. Pastorally put, couples are able to find their way to God through the love they already have for one another. My fourth picture is the picture of the gift of bodies. Now, several writers have drawn attention to some of the parallels between the sacrament of the Eucharist and the sacrament of marriage. Such parallels are latent in Ephesians 5. We all know that Christ gives us his body in the Eucharist. "This is my body." But that is something we also do when a person gives his or her body to their partner and receives the partner's body in return. Now, marriage is not necessary for the giving over of one's body in abandon to a beloved other. But Christians insist there's something unique about marriage, that in the giving and receiving of persons to and from each other, exclusively, faithfully, and permanently, a new vista opens up on marriage. So that physical expression of deep committed love is like saying, "This is my body." Because that's what you're getting, that's what you're receiving, and that is what you're giving. And that's why marriage is sometimes called a mimesis. A mimesis is a strong representation or imitation of something. Mime and mimic come from the same root. Call this the Rory Bremner view, if you want. A very strong representation of something. Okay? Well, marriage mime was at its best, the love of Christ for the church. The author of Ephesians even might tend to agree with that. That in mimesis, there is a strong representation, a strong imitation of something greater. Next, my next model is 5, a sacrament of mutuality. Now, there's a forgotten detail of Western thought, yet another forgotten detail of Western thought about the marital sacrament. Marriage is the only sacrament that does not, or rather did not, need to be administered by a priest. A couple is validly married, assuming no impediment, when they make vows to each other in the present tense before witnesses. What the priest does is he or she pronounces them married and blesses them, but the blessing is not what makes the marriage, as it is in the churches of the East. The Council of Trent required the presence of a priest for the marriage to be valid, and both Catholics and Protestants reacted to the abuses of clandestine marriage by tightening their grip on the entry into it. The point stands. The presence of the priest or minister at a wedding should not eclipse the ancient understanding. The couple minister the sacrament to each other. It is not done to them, it is done by them. It is done to each other. And the great contemporary relevance of this for modern marriage is that an egalitarian marriage is a marriage where there is co-ministry going on, where there is equality in the mutuality of the ministry. The couple marry each other. The sacramental grace is to be found not in something the priest imparts, but in something that the couple discover for themselves as they negotiate and work in and through their relationship of love for one another. The joint ministry of the couple is a fine basis for equal regard marriage. The couple are full and equal partners in the common enterprise. And there is no suggestion that one loves while the other obeys. Now, another picture of marriage is that it is a sign of the coming kingdom. But I'm not going to dwell on that because time is getting on. I just want to say that when Jesus gives us word pictures to think about the end, it's very often a wedding feast or a marriage which becomes the means of thinking joyfully about a time when love conquers all. I'm going to go on to speak instead about marriage as a communion of persons. Pope John Paul II is responsible for developing a strong analogy between relations between human persons and relations between the divine persons within God. And I think this is one of the finest things that John Paul II ever wrote. And one big advantage, of course, is that it's official Roman Catholic teaching. You know, not being thought up by some naughty liberals. So, in the divine Trinity, these persons are distinct persons. But their individuality does not compromise the indivisible unity that God is. God's life is communion. Human life is communion too, yet it is marred by disruption and violence. That's why it needs redemption. Everyone is made for communion with one another and with God. Marital status provides no guarantee or prior condition for the possibility of living in communion. But that said, being married is a communion of persons which involves deep physical intimacy. And it follows that lovemaking in marriage, together with the sharing of marital life which it expresses, provides a powerful and perhaps supreme instance of communion among or between persons. In this communion of persons, which is God, it is possible to share and to share that as the persons in relationship which we already are. So, lastly, marriage as an ascetic discipline, which Eugene Rogers has written about. The argument assumes the requirement of chastity, not celibacy, but chastity, on all Christians, including married ones. It's difficult to remain exclusively faithful to one's married partner. But marriage is a God-given institution, and therefore an ascetic discipline that encourages faithfulness and perseverance. It shares with celibacy the difficulty of remaining chaste, but it requires discipline aided by grace to sustain it. So my final 2-minute pitch is to say, here are 8 pictures of Christian marriage. They're not mine, they're around in the literature. Can they be applied to same-sex marriages? That's the question. And for people who say we haven't done our theology of marriage yet, well, this will do, won't it? For all of these 8 pictures can very obviously be applied to couples of the same sex. Let's imagine a Christian, lesbian, or gay couple who are devoted to each other, who wish to make the same vows to one another before God that straight couples are required to make. They vow to love and cherish each other for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish till death them do part. So they will try to love each other as Christ loved the church. Their relationship is a communion of persons with the hope of growing in deepening love and fruitfulness. Their relationship is a gift of bodies, irrespective of all that white noise about consummation. They wish it to be given further covenantal form by asking for marriage and making their vows before God and the congregation. The church is saying no. A marriage between same-sex couples is as capable as being an icon of the new covenant as any straight marriage, and in addition, it's likely to be less hierarchical, where there is more genuine partnership and give and take than in traditional marriages. A same-sex couple will minister their sacrament to each other. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what Christian marriage is. And will discover the grace of God within it. They can become a unit, a unity of heart, body, and mind. Their joy stands in each other, stands as much an anticipation of the end times, when all barriers to the triumph of love are broken down. That's point 6. And these pictures of marriage, I think, are truly inclusive. They answer the question, what is marriage? Better than some stipulative definitions of marriage, which have been designed to exclude. So that's all I want to say, really. If you want to read more about what I've written about marriage, you might try either of those books. I've got some Making Sense of Sex with me, which I'm prepared to sell at cost. But that's by the way. If you want to download this lecture, it's on the website here, but it's already on my website, so adrianthatcher.org, and click on lectures will get you there. So it's been a long hour, but thank you for your attention.